Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning and welcome to What's Next. Today, we're talking with the Executive Director of Grassroots Garden Western New York, and that's Tim Chen. Tim Chen, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have a chance. I love the whole concept of the urban garden development that we're seeing, not only here, of course, in Buffalo, but elsewhere. And of course, one of the things that really brought us attention, a recent event that you guys had, a soil health symposium, which, you know, I suppose for a lot of people, maybe that makes their eyes roll back and they turn and run away. But for some of us who like to play around in the soil a little bit, it's a lot more interesting for sure. But just kind of the idea of holding an event like that, what was the motivation there?
Yeah, so our organization obviously works, per our name, with gardening, and we work with soil inherently. And some of our work has led us to a partnership currently ongoing with folks at the University at Buffalo, specifically in the materials department, who are working on research that looks at mycelium, which is essentially, you know, for lack of a better term, kind of the roots of mushrooms, the fungal network underground, using mycelium as an opportunity, a venue, essentially to fix lead in the soil, render it inert so it doesn't start leaching off into other things, with the goal of future remediation possibilities. Right. Wow. So we've been working a little bit with them on that. They are, of course, the scientists and doing the in-house lab research, whereas a lot of our work has been focused on making sure that there's more awareness of some of the dangers of planting in urban soils, especially in an industrial or post-industrial city like Buffalo, where there's always a high chance of lead, especially in particular areas where there's been a lot of houses demoed in the past. So that has kind of resulted in both their research hopefully being showcased slowly across different venues, more audiences understanding that there are kind of opportunities that people are exploring to remediate soil, but also making sure that in the absence of remediation opportunities at the moment, people are aware that there may be things they need to be concerned about in their soil and what other solutions there are if they realize they can't plant. So to that end, there's been work in terms of, for example, translating soil safety guides into 9 different languages on top of English, making sure those are free and accessible to folks, especially because we know Buffalo as a hub for new Americans, for refugees. There are a lot of folks who come here and bring their agricultural experience with them, and they might start planting in their own backyards. And they may not know the history of Buffalo. They may not know that there might be lead, there might be asbestos, there might be other heavy metals in the soil. So that access work, that translation work has been really important. We've been having a lot of great opportunities to talk to people who may not even be part of our garden network, part of our community garden network, but they might come to tabling events. They might see literature in their native language, and then we have a conversation with them, tell them a little bit about this work, encourage them to go download the guides from our website to share with their families, their friends who speak their same language, and just really promoting the awareness that, hey, if you are planting in your ground, you need to be aware that there is a risk. And then there are some other solutions, for example, testing or building raised beds to make it a little bit safer for you to plant.
So I think it seems somewhat obvious, but I want to make sure that we understand this. So I think there's this assumption, a house has been raised, we've got these empty lots everywhere in the city of Buffalo, especially on Buffalo's east side. But that being stated, the soil might not be, and most likely maybe is not safe to be using for growing.
Yeah, so Buffalo has some of the oldest housing stock in the country. Most of it was built before 1980. So, you know, lead paint regulations were not existent for most of that period, right? Maybe not all of that period. I don't remember exactly which year it was banned. So there's always that high risk, especially since Buffalo, as many of your listeners probably know, lost 50% of its population once the canal closed. And a lot of these spaces used to have housing, used to have buildings that were raised into the ground. Often the materials were just buried. In a lot of the vacant lots, if you dig down even just half a foot, you'll find just all sorts of stuff in there.
Seemed like a good idea at the time, I guess.
Right. I mean, it's more cost effective, right? And I think this is not necessarily to criticize the demolition of some of those spaces. In fact, in a lot of those cases, it was probably warranted if they were becoming an issue for the community. At the same time, the capacity, the resources were probably not there to make sure it was a completely safe process. So that's a problem now that we're dealing with. I know a lot of the urban farms plant in ground, but they've all done extensive soil testing to make sure that it's safe. And then as far as remediation goes, we don't really have anything large scale available at a cost effective measure that I know of.
What would it take? I mean, when you talk about remediation, what I'm just looking at around at some of the larger scale projects that we've seen around Western New York, and there have been plenty because of just that contaminated soil. I mean, how extensive, let's say, for an average lot in Buffalo, what would go into remediating the soil? That's why you have to take several inches of soil out, I would assume,
probably,
right?
More than several inches. Okay. Right? If you look at, if you're trying to plant and grow vegetables, a lot of roots will go easily more than 12 inches in the ground. Right. Maybe some plants like tomatoes really like to spread out. Other plants like squash, their roots might go 24 inches down in the ground. If you're talking about actually safe practices and full-on remediation right now, I think the only and you could probably talk to someone from like the DEC who would have a lot more experience on brownfield remediation, right? They might have other methods, but to my knowledge, a lot of it is really just trucking out the soil and trucking in new soil. I could do back of the envelope calculations. The cost would be astronomical, even just for a single lot in Buffalo. Which is why when we build gardens with folks, we just buy new soil from a vendor, build raised beds for folks, and ship in the clean soil.
Raised beds are the way to go.
Cost effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is the raised beds. That was a big part, or one of the parts of your symposium. And again, it's one of those things that, it just seems like it'd be easier just to throw it in the ground. You're advising, of course, reminding people not to do that. But a raised garden scenario is fairly easy to do.
I think, we had a number of people come bring their soil for testing. Based on my very short conversation with the community partner from USDA who came in and helped us test things, she said that the soil readings were some of the better ones she's gotten recently, which is great. That's encouraging. And also there are one or two that were kind of beyond the baseline safety level.
All right.
So that's, I think the people who come in, get their soil tested and get a good reading or a good enough reading, it's pretty safe for them, especially since recent research has really shown that a lot of vegetables, especially the ones that we eat the fruit of, for example, pepper, tomatoes, they don't take up as much soil, right? Okay. The ones that you want to pay attention to are root vegetables, like carrots in particular, I think are susceptible to taking up a lot of lead, and leafy greens. So the fruits of the vegetables, or the fruits of the fruits, if you will, if you want to get into semantics, those are generally a lot safer to eat, even if there are traces of lead in the soil. The bigger thing that people should be aware of is really road traffic. The air particles that kind of come up from the street sometimes, if they have lead on them and they land on the surface of the fruit and you don't wash it, that's actually a bigger source sometimes, depending on where you are, than even direct soil uptake. So that's why we always advise people to make sure you wash your hands after you garden and you wash your fruits and veggies before you eat them.
The simple reminders that worth mentioning for sure, right?
But going back to your question about raised beds, It's fairly simple, but it's also fairly simple to build a raised bed that doesn't last you long if you don't have the basic information. And so that's why we really wanted to demonstrate something that told people, hey, if you have trace amounts of lead in your soil, you don't feel comfortable planting in there, you have children, you want to be extra careful, right? This is one step that can make you a little bit safer. And here are the basic tools. Here's the basic knowledge you need to have to build a raised bed that will last you at least 4 or 5 years, be more cost effective, and keep you a little bit safer.
We're talking with Tim Chen this morning on What's Next, the executive director of Grassroots Garden Western New York. A lot of things to talk about here. Maybe let's pull back just a little bit and go a little bit wider. I'm only familiar with what goes on in Buffalo, but is this a national movement? Are we seeing more and more of a focus on urban gardening?
I think so. I could only tell you from the places I've lived and small amounts of research I've done at other garden networks in urban areas. I think there's an overall interest in the food system. So that's one piece of this. You can see it across Buffalo too. There's a lot of food system actors that are interested in more local food procurement, eating more healthily, eating organic, buying from BIPOC growers. So there's a lot of folks in Buffalo and beyond that are working on that. So that's one piece. And I think the other piece that community gardens really offer in a different way than larger scale agriculture is the community connections. People coming together to build a space that everybody can access for free, to enjoy. It's a space where I think really you're seeing, in a lot of ways, the decline of third spaces across the U.S., right, and beyond. Third spaces as in some place outside of work or home where you can interact with your community. And in a lot of ways, third spaces are also places that you have to pay, right? Even if you want to go to a cafe and interact with people in your community, you usually have to buy a cup of coffee and sit down.
Right.
And community gardens are something that increase the walkability of a space. So people are more likely to walk past the place, slow down, look at some things. It puts eyes on the street and makes the community safer because there's more activity outdoors. And it increases those spontaneous interactions that, to me, are really the backbone of building community relationships. If I live in an apartment and I just go up and down the elevator and go to my apartment every day, right, to and from work, I'm not interacting with people. But if there's an outdoor space that my neighbors tend to regularly, eventually I'm going to say hi to them. I'm going to wave to them. I'm going to make small talk, talk about the weather. And that is kind of what forms the basis of relationships. Absent the energy that a lot of times we lack to make these intentional arrangements to build relationships, right? Those spontaneous interactions really form that backbone.
You know, it's interesting to talk about, like you said, these third spaces, and I'm wondering how aware you may or may not be, but just the idea that what that means, so what that, you know, the meaning behind that and the potential benefits, whether it's, we could say, oh, it's just a nice mental health break or whatever the case may be, but do you have an understanding of the value of that type of thing?
I think I understand the value. If you asked me kind of the academic roots of it, I probably knew this like 10 years ago because it was a phrase I'm sure that was coined by probably an urban planner or a sociologist, right? And I think a lot about urban issues in terms of getting into academics a little bit, right?
It's fine.
Jane Jacobs, who wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, is kind of a classic in that space, and she talks a lot about kind of these. She talks about like the sidewalk being a ballet of like people interacting, right? And she also talks a lot about what communal experiences look like, what good planning looks like, what good community building looks like, and she touches on some of these aspects when you talk about what forms a healthy community relationship. There are a number of factors, right? But shared experiences, shared interests, and spontaneous interactions are three of the core ones that I think are critical for us to get to know our neighbors. And then I think in a place like Buffalo, where we have winter half the year, it's essentially one of the only ways that you can build long-term community connections. And so having these spaces, these third spaces that, like I mentioned, are outside of work and outside of your home, are in a lot of ways the only place where people might be able to meet other people, meet their neighbors, and have almost like a communal safety net when things happen, like a blizzard, right? Where your power goes out, who are your resources? They're your neighbors. They're the people you can knock on the door and say, hey, you know, I'm completely out of water. Everything's not running. Can I come in and warm up? So that's an extreme example, but as we know, that's a realistic one, right?
Of course.
In Buffalo.
Yeah. Hey, then let's bring it into Buffalo, maybe talk about how maybe we maybe go through some notable examples, perhaps, maybe that you would know in the city of Buffalo. And I, again, you know, I went to the garden walk, the East Side Garden Walk, and had a chance to see some of the really, you know, lovely gardens. Most of those, of course, that I saw were focused on flowers and things along those lines. But maybe just, if you can, take us through some of these neighborhoods, what you're seeing, and how maybe you've seen changes, you're seeing maybe the results that you're talking about, that those interactions. I'll allow you to maybe expand on some of the locales here in the city.
Yeah, and I'll start with just a very quick brief overview to set the context for what our organization does and how it started as well, because I think that informs the growth of it.
Sure.
Especially our growth into a larger network. Our organization started really in 1995 with a couple of volunteers and residents of the Lower West Side who were just tired of seeing vacant lots being dumped on, the grass uncut. So it started for the first 15 years of our organization's lifetime. It was all volunteers. Okay. There were no staff. A lot of it was fairly informal. People swapping seeds and plants, people putting out calls and getting everybody to a vacant lot, cleaning up all the trash and building it into something a little bit more beautiful, a little bit more beneficial for the community.
Sure.
A lot of it was more focused on probably beautification at that time rather than growing food. And that's been an evolution that has slowly creeped in, I would say, over the last 10, 15 years probably. Excuse me.
That's fine. And feel free to have a drink of water at time, Tim, as I continue to grill you here.
Sure. thanks. So that's the context. It started with a small handful of lots on the Lower West Side.
Right.
And over the 15 years, there was just a ton of interest, right? Like we have discussed, the city of Buffalo has, I want to say, over 15,000 vacant lots right
now. Sounds about right, yeah.
And close to 7,000 of them are owned by the city, 9,000 or so are owned by private property owners, and the city can only do so much, right? They've got their hands full, there's limited capacity, and they're probably understaffed in taking care of some of these spaces, and it was fortunate that we could come to an agreement, have a master lease for a lot of residents who wanted to do something in their community.
Master lease?
Master lease agreement with the city to be able to utilize city-owned lots.
The city-owned lots, okay.
Right. So it was, to me, it's a win-win, right? The city is able to see some neighborhood positivity, have a couple lots that they don't have to take care of, so it saves some man hours for them. And for the neighborhood, it was seeing an opportunity to make the space better rather than the city coming in and just mowing a couple times during the summer and making sure that the grass is cut, but otherwise the spot is vacant. It can be a space where neighbors can meet each other, they can grow food together, they can build a better green space, and it's healthy for things like pollinators. There are all these benefits that happen, right? So that was a fortunate thing that was developed well before my time, a relationship with the city to make sure that that opportunity was available to folks. And then it's really grown, I would say, definitely one of my predecessors, probably two or three executive directors before me, began more of a focus of saying, like, these are resources that we should be sharing, not only with Lower West Side folks, but the East Side especially, like you mentioned,
right,
with all the vacant lots, with the majority of the vacant lots in Buffalo, and also with the history of things like redlining, right? It's an under-resourced community that really deserves attention and has the space to do it. So we've seen this growth, we've seen this interest level continue to increase. Every year we get 5 to 7 different groups applying, whether it's a block club who wants to beautify their space, whether it's church who wants to build a community garden so they can stock a food pantry and feed their congregation, or whether it's a school who wants to build a green space so their students can be educated, can have opportunities to actually put their hands in the soil safely.
Right.
you know, there are all these people who I think are realizing that there's a lot of value, not just to growing healthy food, but to interacting in an experiential way, to kind of be in green spaces, be interacting with nature, and be interacting with one another. So that's something we've seen a lot of.
And have you seen, going back to, you know, what is being grown, it's, you know, the community element, just the, you know, the interaction that's a great benefit with, and to be able to access perhaps to a certain level, you know, something that you can put on your table. I guess what is the capacity for some of these gardens? I mean, how much are they really producing?
They are, so collectively, our friends and partners at the UB Food Lab did a study for us a couple years ago. I want to say it's maybe 2019. And they estimated the network overall, which is 108 gardens this year, maybe 107 gardens, collectively produces around 35,000 pounds of food a year.
Wow.
Which sounds like a lot. Right. And then when you average it out to each garden and then think about how many mouths it feeds in that direct community, you begin to say, oh, that, you know, that's not going to feed 50 families in the immediate neighborhood.
Right.
And they're not intended to, right? There's a reason that our urban farms exist too. They are just as important and more important in different ways.
Of course.
They're the primary food producers as well as kind of our large scale industrial system for agriculture.
Right.
And so that kind of gets to the point that community gardens are set up in a way where we're different from urban farms. We get urban farms have specialists. They hire staff. They take care of all that. They get that produce to market. And a lot of them are really focused on making sure it's accessible and affordable for people. That's great.
Yes.
That's essential. And once again, I think community gardens are unique because we work with folks under a model where we say we are not going around and identifying vacant lots and just plopping down gardens. Our philosophy is really rooted in we only kind of work with and support folks when they come to us and say, we want this. I think getting away from that top-down planning, top-down mandate of what your community should look like is really critical allow people to have agency over what their neighborhood looks like. And that just doesn't just extend to how many boxes they have, but it extends to how our gardens make decisions, how they communicate with each other, with the other gardeners, right? That's all kind of led by neighborhood people who are leaders, are longtime fixtures in their neighborhoods, know the people around, and are able to rally people to do work and make the space a better place. So that's really important to our mission. And that is something to me that sets us apart from a lot of other garden networks I've seen across the country.
Okay.
I've lived in Boston, I've lived in Oregon for a couple of years. And a lot of those places have maybe gated gardens where there's a caretaker or caretaking organization and people pay a nominal fee to rent a bed for the season. Maybe they get a code to the gate so they can access it. And our gardens are all unfenced and they're free and they're open to the public. And that means anybody in the neighborhood, if they want to get a bed, they just talk to the lead gardener. And then the lead gardener talks to us, tells us, hey, you know, we're running out of space. Can you build us two more beds next year?
Oh.
And we'll work with them on that.
Oh, okay.
But once again, it's really driven by neighborhood decision making. We want people to feel like even if they don't technically own the land, they should own the feeling of being able to manage that space because it's in their neighborhood and they're the ones who are taking care of it and making it better.
We are talking with Tim Chen this morning on What's Next. Tim is the executive director of Grassroots Garden Western New York. You mentioned according to that study from UB, 2019, I think it was what you cited there. So it's been a few years, but still, so well over 100 gardens though.
Yes.
Kind of fall under this loose confederacy, I guess, or how about that for a term?
Sure. we say network a lot, but it's probably an overused word. So we can start using confederacy, sure.
There you go. Of course, who knows how charged that term might be these days. But to that, though, again, maybe going back to an earlier thought, I mean, take us to some of these places. I mean, I'm sure you don't have a chance to necessarily go around and monitor what's going on in everyone, but at the same time, you're probably seeing... You're seeing unfold there just what that kind of model, for lack of a better term, that, you know, of a community coming together at a spot and seeing this grow and these opportunities for people. Let's go through some of these anecdotally for you know some of the places around Buffalo, because I think it brings to me at least this kind of idealized sense of what our neighborhoods in the city can be as compared to perhaps what have been stereotypically portrayed.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, which is like having these spaces and communities can spark imagination, can let people understand that the food system is closer to them than they realize sometimes. And even if there's no grocery store within walking distance, you can maybe see someone growing a plant, growing a vegetable in your neighborhood and realize, hey, I don't have a backyard, but maybe I can grow a pot of tomatoes on my deck, right? There are opportunities that can really be inspired by some of these spaces that our gardeners are creating. I think there are some stories that we've been starting to collect a little bit. Next year is our 30th anniversary.
Okay.
So now that we have a slightly larger staff team, we're actually finding capacity to go back and say, hey, 10 years ago, we had 2 people and, almost 100 gardens.
Right.
Now we have 6 people. We can actually go back and examine some of these histories a little bit more because they are very inspiring and we just haven't had the time and capacity to capture them in the past. So we're really looking forward to being able to do more of that. I think some stories I've heard recently, one example would be over on York Street, near the Little Summer area, which is a very popular garden walk destination.
Right.
Very beautiful little quirky houses in that area, and a number of amazing individual gardens that people have curated. And there's a community garden down the street from there that was a chop shop in a now demolished house.
Oh, okay.
That was operating all hours of the day. People were just absolutely sick of kind of the activity that was going around there. They work with Councilmember Rivera, I believe at the time, to eventually get the house torn down. And then I think there was also maybe a dogfighting ring or a cockfighting ring in the back.
Mm.
A lot of stuff that the neighborhood just really was not benefiting. It was detrimental to the area.
Put a label perhaps on that area. Yeah.
And the neighbors banded together. Maybe 2 people pulled their resources and bought the lot.
Oh, wow.
And they converted it with the neighbors' help into a community garden. There's a very dramatic before and after photo that I like to show people because it is a vegan lot just absolutely filled with trash. It's just incredible. And then we have an after photo of the space, I think just like 3 years afterwards, and it's this incredible garden space. And that was all just the neighbors rolling up their sleeves and saying, hey, we want better for ourselves. We deserve better. We're going to do this. That was before my time, so I can't really speak to kind of the level of resource exchange that happened between different gardens and grassroots gardens that led to that transformation. But that's the goal, right, is to say people deserve better spaces in their communities, and we're here to help make that happen.
I'm also curious, and again, I'm going to ask you as more of an anecdotal type of question or inquiry here, but, the idea that, again, there's that stereotype that it's city neighborhoods where people don't care. And like you said, like the place on York Street you're talking about, garbage was piled up and now there's this beautiful space. And I guess what I'm wondering, are we seeing these spaces being left alone by that type of thing, generally speaking? I mean, are we seeing just that's I don't want to say a sacred space, but a space that's very special and that it's getting a certain level of respect in neighborhoods?
That's a great question. I would hope so. Mm-hmm. I think I have been at grassroots gardens since 2020. There are always occasional cases where we get complaints from gardeners saying, hey, this happened. Can you help us? Right. A lot of it really is occasional overharvesting. People who don't garden there coming in maybe at night, maybe not really understanding how the space is operated and taking, for example, all the ripe tomatoes in one go. And that is probably the biggest thing that sometimes happens. And the hope, of course, is always that whoever took it needs the food more than the gardeners. But it can be a very frustrating thing that happens, right? And that's the balance that we have to find between we could put up all, well, if we had the money, we could put up fences at all the gardens.
Right.
But that's not the goal. The goal is for it to be a communal space where people feel welcome.
Sure.
So we have really worked on trying to create more, better signage, inclusive signage, whether it's different languages translated into making sure people understand the garden policies, having small signs asking people to respect the amount of work gardeners put in and only take a couple rather than taking everything, little things like that that are kind of the first steps towards addressing that. But by and large, I think our gardens have, like you said, received that level of respect. I think about our office garden, which is over on Broadway and Hickory.
Right.
It's a big lot. And there's a lot of car traffic and a decent amount of foot traffic in that area. And of course, our staff don't live, you know, at our office.
Right.
So it's not a situation like a lot of our community gardens where neighbors can look out the window and see what's happening. And it's been a thriving space overall. We have folks across the street in two housing complexes who keep an eye out for us because they appreciate the space. They understand they can come and pick things and sit at the picnic table and have lunch or hang out with their grandkids whenever they want. And so they'll call us, right? One time the garage door was left open by accident and I got a call from a neighbor saying, hey, just a heads up, right? Your garage door is open. It's 6:30. I don't think anybody's there. So that was, and that's not something we asked of them. We didn't say, hey, can you make sure you watch our space for us? That just happened naturally because I think they saw the commitment we were dedicating to that space, where now we have a number of neighbors who are gardening as well.
Yeah, well, let's talk about your space then, because that's something you probably see every day. Probably not spending necessarily your whole day in the garden, but so what will we find over there, Broadway and Hickory?
We've got a beautiful pollinator berm that previous employees built while they were here in 2020.
A pollinator berm?
Just a big pollinator bed along the street that has all sorts of native perennials that are good for pollinators.
All right, nice.
Good for butterflies, bees, you know, the things that pollinate our vegetables so we can eat.
Right.
And you've got a beautiful kind of trellis up front with wisteria coming down. It finally bloomed this past year after a couple years of waiting for it to do so.
You're patient enough to allow it to go. Oh, nice.
Well, I work there. I have to wait for it, right? We've got a couple of, I think, 12 or 13 raised beds right now that are the shorter raised beds close to the ground. I want to say five of them are tended to by neighbors who live in the area right now. And then we've got a number of taller raised beds that have kind of slanted sides. Those are wheelchair accessible raised beds. And, you know, they're also just better for people like me who have kind of low back issues and don't like crawling and squatting and kneeling on the ground. It's an initiative that we've been trying to do across our garden network as well, is improving the height of a lot of the raised beds.
Okay.
It both improves the root depth of vegetables, right? But it also makes it so people who have mobility limitations are able to garden a little bit more easily. And especially since we have an aging gardener population too, right? Making it easier so they don't have to be kneeling on the ground, so they don't have to be bending forwards and weeding, and they can do it at kind of a standing waist level height. That's something that is a big focus of ours. We have a small greenhouse that was donated. It's more of a little hoop house that we do some seed starting. Unfortunately, it probably gets a little too hot in there in the summer to do anything else.
Okay.
The ventilation needs a little bit of improvement. So that's a project that we're working on.
Okay. Then, you know, you just mentioned like the older gardener, you know, I can most certainly appreciate that as I'm getting to that hopeful age where maybe that's all I can, I'm going to be doing during the day. But who is gardening? Who are we seeing gardening?
Everybody. I mean, like I mentioned, we have 100+ gardens in our network. About 30 of them are school gardens.
Oh.
So you're seeing teachers really, and I have a lot of admiration for teachers. My wife's a teacher, so I kind of have to say that too. but these are folks who, on top of their existing job with the school, are taking it upon themselves to create activities that can not only teach a new skill, spur new interests, but get people outside of the classroom. Or rather get people in a different type of classroom, right? So they can learn in a different way than sitting at a desk or a screen. And that's, like I mentioned, usually on top of their existing workload. They're just willing to do this. So that's really encouraging. And I think there are a lot of other programs out there that are doing more youth-related job training, around green infrastructure, around gardening. You look at places like the Massachusetts Avenue Project, which has been running their youth program for I don't know how many years at this point.
Right.
And that's a great example, right, of folks who are educating the next generation to both have skills, whether it's in marketing, whether it's in growing, but also understand the importance of taking care of our environment and making sure that we're growing things that are feeding humans, but also animals.
We're talking with Tim Chen this morning on What's Next. He is the executive director of Grassroots Garden, Western New York. Tim, you mentioned how earlier the USDA was at your soil symposium. So there's a federal government assistance to a certain extent. And I think somewhere along the lines on your website, I saw a HUD grant came in, or if you were able to utilize some money from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I'm curious about that. Maybe you can explore to the best of your knowledge, you know, how much is this type of effort, which does seem so admirable to establish these community spaces with healthy foods inside neighborhoods that, you know, are looking to revitalize or trying to revitalize. How much are you seeing that on a federal level from a policy level? Is this getting that kind of attention?
I think so. I think more and more so, right? And you asked the question earlier about is this on the rise across the country?
Yeah.
I would say statewide it's getting a lot more attention for urban agriculture and community gardening right now from the state's administration. And there's a community gardens task force that I'm sitting on right now.
Statewide?
Statewide,
okay.
Right? That's looking into training future community garden leaders. They're building a curriculum for that and hoping to recruit people in the fall. So there's I would say, more funding available for a lot of urban agriculture now compared to years past.
On a state level?
On a state level,
okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay.
So that's encouraging. On the USDA level, there's always a lot of attention and support for farm-to-school initiatives to connect exactly that level of education process to more local farms, allow people to explore that potentially as a career path long-term, but also just to make sure that our children, right, our youth are fed healthy, ideally local foods in the school system when they go and get school lunches. So there's a lot of different prongs of this process that are occurring across the board. And a lot of it is really food focused, which is great. I think that's a really critical piece of moving this work forwards, because we are in a market-based economy. And if you don't address kind of the procurement and supply chain processes, sometimes it's tough to kind of get that policy follow-up to make sure there's the resources devoted to that.
It's interesting you bring up the supply chain policies, and maybe I'm going to, again, try to infringe on maybe a level of expertise that you may or may not have, so I apologize for that. But, you know, May 14th, 2022, we'll always remember that, and of course, it brought to light the whole concept of a food desert, and that these supply chains are shaky in some neighborhoods for sure. I'm wondering if you can kind of educate us a little bit on, you know, how that comes, because it becomes, we can use the term food desert, food apartheid, and it becomes kind of a cliche that we just throw around, mm-hmm. But how do we really see that playing out? I mean, how can you help us understand that?
Yeah, I am a more recent returning to Buffalo, right?
Yeah.
So I would absolutely, I think there are plenty of people out there who have been in Buffalo much longer than I, who would be more qualified to speak to the impacts and what people have seen for decades, really.
Right.
And you mentioned the kind of the distinction between food deserts and food apartheid. And of course, I think a lot of the recent dialogue has really focused on the fact that deserts are naturally occurring ecosystems.
Yes.
Whereas we talk about kind of the lack of food access, lack of grocery stores as really a planning decision, right? A plan to say, hey, that place is not where we want to build a business. We're not going to go there. So that's why the term food apartheid, I think, is more widely used now, is to say there's an intentionality behind why this happened.
Right.
And the intentionality behind that is, you know, maximize profit, right? To make sure that we're building in higher capital areas, and then all these different pockets like the east side of Buffalo get ignored for years and years.
Right.
So I think we're at kind of a first step of that process of understanding not just, oh, it's too bad this happened, right? And we're going to build more food banks and ship food over there. I think that's certainly needed. But the understanding that there is a planning process that led to this means that there's a better equitable way that people can, decision makers, people who have more experience, more expertise, and more power than I do, of course, right. Are able to factor that when they're looking at things like funding streams, right? Who do you support? Who do you open these, make these grants available to? Is it BIPOC growers? Or black farmers, right? Who, if you look at the history of land ownership across the U.S., that's a whole other question,
yes,
right?
Oh, yes, yes.
But that's a huge issue of why there are very few black farmers proportionally.
USDA policy historically,
right?
Yeah.
And so those are previous wrongs that need to be righted. And I feel like we're just at the starting point of beginning to even acknowledge that that's an issue.
Right.
So there's a lot of larger systems that need to be at work and are slowly getting in gear, hopefully, to address some of those pieces. I would say our organization specifically does not do market-based things. We don't sell produce from our gardens. So that whole kind of business side of things, I don't feel like I'm the best person
to say
what should happen in Buffalo.
Right.
But there are a lot of people who are working on that, and I can certainly send you some names later on if you want to follow up with them.
That would be fine. But I appreciate the answer because I just think, though, and I think you just brought it up right there, it's an issue, talking about food apartheid, food deserts, food chains, all the other different types of things, it doesn't get a ton of conversation. You know, as I mentioned, and so I guess I appreciate you addressing it in that regard, for sure, and just bringing a little bit to that. I'm curious, though, how about for you, though, when you just your general walk of life, as you're, you know, people get to know you and they find out what you do for a living, what's the response? What are their thoughts and questions to you when they find out that you're the executive director of Grassroots Garden Western New York and that you're, you know, helping to initiate and keep these community gardens going here in the city of Buffalo?
I think most people think it's a very hard job. Not my personal job, but it's very hard work to do. Because like you mentioned, right, there are a lot of barriers, and in a lot of our community gardens, you asked about, you know, are these spaces respected? Are there negative things that happen? It takes one or two people to really screw up a public space and frustrate people to the point where they say, hey, I don't want to work in this space anymore.
Right.
So I think often people have several reactions. One is, that's amazing work. Tell me more. And the idea sometimes of community ownership of these spaces takes a long time to explain. I think we're just not used to that.
Sure.
I think we have been told as kind of average citizens often that if you don't own a land outright, right, if you don't own that space outright, you can't do things to it. And there's this idea of public land, of city-owned land. We say city-owned land, but it's public land, right? It's taxpayer dollar-funded land to manage these spaces. So we believe that there should be a community benefit there. And that's something we're actively working on to try to figure out, hey, what avenues can we do, can we pursue to make sure that these spaces eventually become community assets rather than spaces where people are saying, hey, nobody's taking care of that spot. It's a blight. It's a detriment to the community. I think another reaction is people default to the other side of things where they say, oh, that's great, but don't you have all these other issues that are happening, right? What about, like, don't people steal your stuff? Don't people vandalize it? Don't people not weed and water? And all those can be true at the same time, I think, because there's a lot of hopeful imagination that these spaces can create. There's a lot of community connections that these spaces can create. And there are also challenges that continue to pop up. We see, because they are public spaces, public issues pop up in these spaces, right?
Okay.
Whether it's our affordable housing or lack thereof in some spaces, meaning that the neighborhood is not stable, and long-term gardeners see some of their support in the community drying up, because you have renters cycling through every 6 months, every 3 months. Those people are not going to have the time to say, I'm going to commit to doing this garden project for right. a whole season, much less several years, because they're going to move in 2 months. So that level of community stability or lack thereof can be a challenge. And it's an interesting process where we see that manifesting in these public garden spaces, where garden leaders are coming to us and saying, hey, this is really hard right now because X, Y, and Z. But it's also really fascinating because all these different aspects coalesce in these spaces,
right.
whether it's affordability, and that goes all the way down to unhoused folks needing a space to even set up their tent, right? That can be a challenge too, to figure out, all right, you know, we want people to have a place to sleep at night, and is this a safe thing for the neighborhood as far as discovering needles? There's a lot of kind of public space questions that start popping up sometimes that are so broad that they're no longer a gardening question.
Okay.
It's a societal question.
Right.
And while that's maybe very interesting, it keeps our jobs maybe more challenging than we want it to be. It's also a really interesting snapshot to look at what is actually happening in communities. It's going to happen in these communal spaces. It's going to happen as far as potentially having language barriers with a lot of people needing more support to figure out how to communicate to their new neighbors, hey, this is what the space is, and this is how we work in this space, and this is how you can help. It's related to the housing questions that I just mentioned. It's related to stewardship and allowing elderly folks, older people, to age in place with quality of life and continue stewarding the space that they're used to stewarding. So I would say, you know, my answer to that is it's intellectually so interesting to me. And then there are so many limits that we run into as well of saying, hey, we have six people in our organization, and this is the amount of capital or resources we have to address these questions. And what we're seeing manifest in these spaces is actually a result of all these other
right.
policy questions that we don't have the ability to address. We don't have the power or authority to address.
And it does also bring us to an element that's on your website, and I almost overlooked it, but you know, I think there's in a menu of how can I get involved? Well, what about that? What can people do? Because I think, like you said, you've just touched on so many issues, societal, but most certainly here in the city of Buffalo. And the one thing that is very gratifying from our end here is that, you know, we're finding that there's a connection. You know, there are so many people who want to do things to help this community. Here's an opportunity. What can people do?
Yeah. There's a lot people can do, and some of it can start with us, and some of it can just be on their own block. We mm-hmm. always tell people they don't have to come through us to build a community garden. We just offer that support if they want it.
So they could, if there's a vacant space,
there's a vacant space, and they can figure out the land ownership and get approval okay. to
figure
to
out
do
the
it, right?
figure out the land ownership.
Yeah, don't
okay.
just. I mean, on the record, I can't encourage people to just start building places right. Without approval from the owner.
Right.
this year we started our first kind of individual volunteer program. In the past, we've always worked a lot with corporate groups, student groups who come in and do a couple big projects throughout the year, tackle some of the bigger things like dismantling old beds, building new raised beds that sometimes are hard for gardeners to take on their own. And that's been wonderful. We've really appreciated those partnerships. And we also get a lot of individual folks reaching out to us and saying, what can I do?
Okay.
Right? Can I help? When I was hired at Grassroots Gardens in 2020, I was a third full-time staff member. And we were already working with that level of the number of gardens that I mentioned earlier, 100 plus.
Right.
And so we didn't have the capacity to really provide that individual volunteer experience that people are looking for and give enough guidance. And have those connections. I think people are looking often for social connections as well as the opportunity to give back when they volunteer. And we just didn't have the ability to do that effectively. Now we have more capacity to do that. So we started that this year, starting with the volunteer orientation in February. And we've had a couple volunteer events every month so far, whether it's going out to garden and doing the really simple tasks of helping them take care of some invasive species that are taking over, whether it's learning how to prune some trees and shrubs and then giving a garden a little bit of a makeover. This fall, we'll be doing some raised bed building to kind of renovate old beds in preparation for next spring, just get a head start on that. So there are a lot of opportunities to sign up on our website, usually for a volunteer program, where you can pick which skill you want to learn or which activity you want to do and sign up for just that one, right? There's not a high level of commitment, say, hey, if you sign up for a volunteer, you need to show up to five different things. Okay. Sign up for the one thing you want to do, right? See it as a workshop, as an opportunity to connect with other people, but also as an opportunity to help out people, gardeners, who are making a difference in their own communities.
You know, before we break away here on the show, you guys are centered in Buffalo. It is called Grassroots Garden of Western New York. You also have a footprint in Niagara Falls.
Yeah, it's a smaller footprint. A lot of our gardens in Niagara Falls are church and school gardens.
Okay.
Those are the gardens that we've seen be able to harness enough people to steward the spaces regularly. But we're always looking. We're always happy to talk to people who want to start something. Every year, we get up a couple people reaching out to us from Niagara Falls asking how to start a garden. A lot of times we'll walk people through the process and they might say, all right, this sounds like a lot of work. I'll try again next year. Or they reach out to us in July and it's a little bit late to start that process.
It's about time I start my gardening every year. That's why I'm poor at it.
Well, you can still plant some stuff for the fall for sure. A lot of leafy greens and radishes and beets will thrive if you plant them late summer because they do well with the frost.
You can still plant beets?
You can still plant them.
Really?
Okay. They're fast growing enough that beets will be done probably if you plant them in the ground around now before the frost hits, and then leafy greens usually do fine. Collards, kale, even lettuces and spinaches will do fine when the first frost hits. Usually they'll still be okay for a little bit.
Okay.
Niagara Falls, we do work up there. It's a smaller footprint, like you mentioned. But one of our biggest gardens is actually up there. It's the LaSalle Vineyard Garden. It's right next to the waterfront on Buffalo Ave. It's this huge, beautiful garden that is on a city-owned lot. It's owned by the Niagara Falls municipality. And they've got all sorts of stuff. They grew hops there one year and made made beer out of it. They have grapevines and grapes. I think they made wine and had it served for communion at a local church.
Wow, that's great.
So they've got a great group of guys up there or people up there who have been taking care of that space for a number of years, and it's probably the biggest garden in our network.
I know you were your undergrad degree was in biology, but did you ever think you'd know this much about gardening?
I didn't think about it. I was more of an animal person. Looking at fauna more than flora, I would say. And native plants are something that I've gotten a little bit more into recently, mostly thanks to one of our staff members who's just so knowledgeable about it. Short answer is I didn't think I would be end up with growing things very much. But it's been a really interesting intersection of my interests, personal interest in both biology and environment, but also in urban planning and community development. I think I touched on a lot of these things earlier as far as these spaces not just being spaces to grow food, right? But to grow people, to grow all our health, whether it's physical health or also mental health, having green space access to people is critical. So it is a surprising but satisfying kind of meeting of a lot of my interests.
And Tim, I guess the final question here, and I think I have the answer, but as I've kind of pelted you with these questions, I've invited you to take these roundabout analyses of different issues here in the city of Buffalo. But are you optimistic about how this is going to move forward? The idea of the grassroots garden?
Yeah, I can't help but be hopeful. I think. I'm not saying that just because it's my job to say so, but really because, once again, our organization is really rooted on people rolling up their sleeves and taking charge of their communities. It's not a top-down process where we come into communities and say, hey, you need green space and you need a garden. It's people deciding that on their own. And that is, I think, the most hopeful thing you can consider, right? I think it was maybe back in March when Robin Wall Kimmerer came and spoke. She's an ethnobotanist, teaches at, I think, SUNY ESF.
Okay. In Syracuse, yeah.
Yeah, outside of Syracuse. Incredible writer. Highly recommend if people are interested in kind of becoming more aware and in tune with our natural world and finding gratitude for that. But she said something along the lines of, if you want to inspire hope, you can raise good children, you can raise a ruckus, or you can raise a garden. And I found that, I mean, it's really, really inspiring because I think we hear so much about what's wrong, what the issues are. And there are a lot of issues, but there are also a lot of people out there who are addressing them in the ways that they can. And to have that kind of hope-centered mindset is critical for us to be able to move forwards, especially in the light of a lot of these larger scale problems that it might feel powerless for us individually to address. So short answer, yes, I feel very hopeful. We've got an amazing group of folks across the network who are just doing all this incredible work in their communities. And we're hopeful that more and more people will be joining us.
Well, Tim Chen, we are very pleased that you're able to join us this morning on What's Next. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great talking to you.
Tim Chen, you can now finally drink some water and rest your vocal cords. Tim Chen is the executive director of Grassroots Garden, Western New York. This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.